Silas Marner by George Eliot. Part 1, Chapter 6. The conversation, which was at a high pitch of animation when Silas approached the door of the Rainbow, had, as usual, been slow and intermittent when the company first assembled. The pipes began to be puffed in a silence which had an air of severity. The more important customers who drank spirits and sat nearest the fire, staring at each other as if a bet were depending on the first man who winked, while the beer drinkers, chiefly men in fustian jackets and smock frocks, kept their eyelids down and rubbed their hands across their mouths, as if their draughts of beer were a funereal duty attended with embarrassing sadness. At last, Mr. Snell, the landlord, a man of a neutral disposition, accustomed to stand aloof from human differences as those of beings who were all alike in need of liquor, broke silence by saying in a doubtful tone to his cousin the butcher,
"Some folks would say that was a fine beast you drove in yesterday, Bob."
The butcher, a jolly, smiling, red-haired man, was not disposed to answer rashly. He gave a few puffs before he spat and replied,
"And I wouldn't be fur wrong, John."
After this feeble, delusive thaw, the silence set in as severely as before.
"Was it a red Durham?"
said the farrier, taking up the thread of discourse after the lapse of a few minutes. The farrier looked at the landlord, and the landlord looked at the butcher, as the person who must take the responsibility of answering.
"Red it was," said the butcher in his good, humoured, husky treble, "and a Durham it was."
"Then you needn't tell me who you bought it of," said the farrier, looking round with some triumph. "I know who it is as got the red Durhams of this countryside, and she'd a white star on her brow, I'll bet a penny."
The farrier leaned forward with his hands on his knees as he put this question, and his eyes twinkled knowingly.
"Well, yes, she might," said the butcher,
slowly considering that he was giving a decided affirmative.
"I don't say contrary."
"I knew that very well," said the farrier,
throwing himself backward again and speaking defiantly.
"If I don't know Mr. Lammeter's cows, I should like to know who does, that's all. And as for the cow you've bought, bargain or no bargain, I've been at the drenching of her, contradict me who will."
The farrier looked fierce, and the mild butcher's conversational spirit was roused a little.
"I'm not for contradicting no man," he said. "I'm for peace and quietness. Some are for cutting long ribs, I'm for cutting them short myself. But I don't quarrel with them. All I say is, it's a lovely carcass, and anybody as was reasonable, it'd bring tears into their eyes to look at it."
"Well, it's the cow as I drenched, whatever it is," pursued the farrier angrily. "And it was Mr. Lammeter's cow, else you told a lie when you said it was a red Durham."
"I tell no lies," said the butcher, with the same mild huskiness as before, "and I contradict none, not if a man was to swear himself black. He's no meat of mine, nor none of my bargains. All I say is, it's a lovely carcass, and what I say I'll stick to, but I'll quarrel with no man."
"No," said the farrier with bitter sarcasm, looking at the company generally, "and perhaps you aren't pig-headed, and perhaps you didn't say the cow was a red Durham, and perhaps you didn't say she'd got a star on her brow. Stick to that now you're at it."
"Come, come," said the landlord, "let the cow alone. The truth lies atween you. You're both right, and both wrong, as I always says. And as for the cow's being Mr. Lammeter's, I say nothing to that. But this I say, as the Rainbow's the Rainbow. And for the matter of that, if the talk is to be the Lammeter's, you remember when first Mr. Lammeter's father came into these parts and took the Warrens?"
Mr. Macy, tailor and parish clerk, the latter of which functions rheumatism had of late obliged him to share with the small-featured young man who sat opposite him, held his white head on one side and twirled his thumbs with an air of complacency, slightly seasoned with criticism. He smiled pityingly in answer to the landlord's appeal and said,
I know. But I let other folks talk. I've laid by now and give up to the young'uns. Ask them as have been to school at Tarley. They've learnt pronouncin'. That's come up since my day."
"If you're pointing at me, Mr. Macy," said the deputy clerk with an air of anxious propriety, "I'm no wiser man to speak out of my place. As the psalm says, I know what's right, or only so, but also practice what I know."
"Well, then I wish you'd keep hold of the tune when it's set for you. If you're practicin', I wish you'd practice that,"
said a large, jocose-looking man, an excellent wheelwright in his weekday capacity, but on Sundays leader of the choir. He winked as he spoke at two of the company, who were known officially as the bassoon and the key bugle, in the confidence
that he was expressing the sense of the musical profession in Raveloe. Mr. Tookie, the deputy clerk, who shared the unpopularity common to deputies, turned very red but replied with careful moderation, "Mr. Winthrop, if you'll bring me any proof, as I'm in the wrong, I'm not the man to say I won't alter. But there's people set up their own ears for a standard and expect the whole choir to follow 'em. There may be two opinions, I hope."
"Aye, aye,"
said Mr. Macy, who felt very well satisfied with this attack on youthful presumption.
"You're right there, Tookie. There's allers two opinions. There's the opinion a man has of himself, and there's the opinion other folks have on them. There'd be two opinions about a cracked bell if the bell could hear itself."
"Well, Mr. Macy," said poor Tookie, serious amidst the general laughter, "I undertook to partially fill up the office of parish clerk by Mr. Crackenthorpe's desire, whenever your infirmities should make you unfitting, and it's one of the rights thereof to sing in the choir. Else why have you done the same yourself?"
"Ah! But the old gentleman and your two folks," said Ben Winthrop. "The old gentleman's got a gift. Why, the squire used to invite him to take a glass, only to hear him sing the Red Rover. Didn't he, Mr. Macy? It's a natural gift. There's my little lad Aaron. He's got a gift. He can sing a tune off straight like a throstle. But as for you, Master Tookie, you'd better stick to your amens. Your voice is well enough when you keep it up in your nose. It's your inside as isn't right made for music. It's no better nor a hollow stalk."
This kind of unflinching frankness was the most piquant form of joke to the company at the Rainbow, and Ben Winthrop's insult was felt by everybody to have capped Mr. Macy's epigram.
"I see what it is plain enough," said Mr. Tookie, unable to keep cool any longer. "There's a conspiracy to turn me out of the choir, as I shouldn't share the Christmas money. That's where it is. But I shall speak to Mr. Crackenthorpe. I'll not be put upon by no man."
"Nay, nay, Tookie," said Ben Winthrop. "We'll pay you your share to keep out of it. That's what we'll do. There's things folks would pay to be rid of besides varmin."
"Come, come," said the landlord, who felt that paying people for their absence was a principle dangerous to society.
"A joke's a joke. We're all good friends here, I hope. We must give and take. You're both right, and you're both wrong, as I say. I agree with Mr. Macy here, as there's two opinions, and if mine was asked, I should say they're both right. Tookie's right, and Winthrop's right, and they've only got to split the difference and make themselves even."
The farrier was puffing his pipe rather fiercely in some contempt at this trivial discussion. He had no ear for music himself, and never went to church, as being of the medical profession and likely to be in requisition for delicate cows. But the butcher, having music in his soul, had listened with a divided desire for Tookie's defeat and for the preservation of the peace.
"To be sure," he said, following up the landlord's conciliatory view, "we're fond of our old clerk. It's natural, and him used to be such a singer, and got a brother as is known for the first fiddler in this countryside. Ah, it's a pity but what Solomon lived in our village and could give us a tune when we liked, eh, Mr. Macy? I'd keep him in liver and lights for nothing, that I would."
"Aye, aye," said Mr. Macy in the height of complacency. "Our family's been known for musicianeers as far back as anybody can tell. But then things are dying out, as I tell Solomon every time he comes round. There's no voices like what there used to be, and there's nobody remembers what we remember, if it isn't the old crows.
Aye. You remember when first Mr. Lambert's father came into these parts, don't you, Mr. Macy?"
said the landlord.
"I should think I did,"
said the old man, who had now gone through that complimentary process necessary to bring him up to the point of narration.
"And a fine old gentleman he was. As fine, and finer nor the Mr. Lammeter as now is. He came from a bit northward, so far as I could ever make out. But there's nobody rightly knows about those parts, only it couldn't be far northward, nor much different from this country, for he brought a fine breed of sheep with him, so there must be pastures there, and everything reasonable. We heard tell as he'd sold his own land to come and take the Warrens, and that seemed odd for a man as had land of his own to come and rent a farm in a strange place. But they said it was along of his wife's dying, though there's reasons and things as nobody knows on. That's pretty much what I've made out. Yet some folks are so wise they'll find you 50 reasons straight off, and all the while the real reason's winking at 'em in the corner, and they never see it. Howsomever, it was soon seed as we got a new parishioner as knowed the rights and custom of things, and kept a good house, and was well looked on by everybody. And the young man, that's the Mr. Lammeter as now is, for he'd never a sister, soon begun to court Miss Osgood. That's the sister of the Mr. Osgood as now is, and a fine, handsome lass she was. Oh, you can't think. They pretend this young lass is like her, but that's the way with people as don't know what come before them. I should know, for I helped the old rector, Mr. Drumlow, as was, I helped him marry him."
Here Mr. Macy paused. He always gave his narrative in instalments, expecting to be questioned according to precedent.
"Aye, and a particular thing happened, didn't it, Mr. Macy, so as you were likely to remember that marriage," said the landlord, in a congratulatory tone.
"I should think there did. A very particular thing," said Mr. Macy, nodding sideways. "For Mr. Drumlow, poor old gentleman, I was fond on him, though he'd got a bit confused in his head what were age and were taking a drop or something warm whenever the service come of a cold morning. And young Mr. Lammeter, he'd have no way, but he must be married in January, which, to be sure's a unreasonable time to be married in, for it isn't like a christening or a burying, as you can help. And so Mr. Drumlow, poor old gentleman, I was fond on him, but when he come to put the questions, he put him by the rule contrary-like, and he says, 'Wilt thou have this man to thy wedded wife?' says he. And then he says, 'Wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded husband?' says he. But the particularest thing of all is, as nobody took any notice on it but me, and they answered straight off yes, like as if it had been me saying amen in the right place without listening to what went before. But you knew what was going on well enough, didn't you, Mr. Macy? You alive enough, eh?" said the butcher.
"Oh, Lord bless you,"
said Mr. Macy, pausing and smiling in pity at the impotence of his hearer's imagination.
"Why, I was all of a tremble. It was as if I'd been a coat pulled by the two tails, like, for I couldn't stop the parson. I couldn't take it upon me to do that. And yet I says to myself, I says, 'Suppose they shouldn't be fast married, because the words are contrary.' And my head went working like a mill, for I was always uncommon for turning things over and seeing all round 'em. And I says to myself, 'Isn't the meaning of the words as makes folks fast a wedlock? For the parson meant right, and the bride and bridegroom meant right. But then, when I come to think on it, meaning goes but a little way of the most things, for you may mean to stick things together and your glue may be bad, and then where are you? And so I says to myself, "It isn't the meaning, it's the glue." And I was worried as if I'd got three bellows to pull at once when we went into the vestry and they begun to sign their names. But where is the use of talking? You can't think what goes on in a cute man's inside.
But you held in for all that, didn't you, Mr. Macy? Said the landlord.
Aye. I held in tight till I was by myself with Mr. Drumlow, and then I, with everything but respectful, as I always did, and he made light on it, and he says, 'Oh, pooh-pooh, Macy, make yourself easy,' he says. 'It's neither the meaning nor the words. It's the register does it. That's the glue.' So you see, he settled it easy, for parsons and doctors know everything by heart, like as so they aren't worried with thinking what's the rights and wrong of things, as I've been many and many of the time. And sure enough, the wedding turned out all right. Only poor Mrs. Lammeter, that's Miss Osgood as was, died afore the lasses was growed up, and for prosperity and everything respectable, there's no family more looked on.'"
Every one of Mr. Macy's audience had heard this story many times, but it was listened to as if it had been a favourite tune, and at certain points the puffing of the pipes was momentarily suspended, that the listeners might give their whole minds to the expected words. But there was more to come, and Mr. Snell, the landlord, duly put the leading question.
"Why, old Mr. Lammeter had a pretty fortin, didn't they say, when he come into these parts?"
"Hut, well, yes," said Mr. Macy. "But I dare say it's as much as this Mr. Lammeter's done to keep it whole, for there was always a talk as nobody could get rich on the Warrens, though he holds it cheap, for it's what they call charity land."
"Aye, and there's few folks know so well as you how it comes to be charity land, eh, Mr. Macy?"
said the butcher.
"How should they?" said the old clerk with some contempt. "Why, my grandfather made the groom's livery for that Mr. Cliffis come and built the big stables at the Warrens. Why, their stable's four times as big as Squire Cass's, for he thought of nothing but horses and hunting. Cliff didn't, a Lunnon tailor, some folks said, as had gone mad with cheating, for he couldn't ride, Lord bless you. They said he got no more grip of the horse than if his legs had been cross-sticks. The grandfather heard old Squire Cass say so many and many a time, but ride he would, as if old Harry had been a-driving him, and he'd a son, a lad of 16, and nothing would his father have him do but he must ride and ride, though the lad was frighted, they said, and it was a common saying as the father wanted to ride the tailor out of the lad and make a gentleman on him, but not what I'm a tailor myself, but in respect as God made me such, I'm proud on it. For Macy Taylor's been rode up over our door since afore the Queen's heads went out on the shillings. But
Cliff, he was ashamed of being called a tailor, and he was so vexed as his riding was laughed at, and nobody of the gentlefolks hereabout could abide him. However, the poor lad got sickly and died, and the father didn't live long after him, for he got queerer nor ever, and they said he used to go out of the dead of the night with a lantern in his hand to the stables and set a lot of lights burning, for he got as he couldn't sleep, and there he'd stand cracking his whip and looking at his horses, and they said it was a mercy as the stables didn't get burnt down with the poor dumb creatures in 'em. But at last he died raving, and they found as he'd left all his property, warrens and all, to a London charity. And that's how the warrens came to be charity land, though as for the stables, Mr. Lammeter never uses them. They're out of all character, Lord bless you. If you was to set the doors a-banging in 'em, it'd sound like thunder half o'er the parish. Aye, but there's more going on in the stables than what folks see by daylight, eh, Mr. Macy? Said the landlord. Aye, aye, go that way of a dark night, that's all, said Mr. Macy, winking mysteriously, and then make believe if you like, as you didn't see lights at the stables, nor hear the stamping of the horses, nor the cracking of the whips, and howling, too, if it's taught daybreak. Cliff's Holiday has been the name of it ever since I were a boy. That's to say, some said as it was the holiday old Harry gave him from roasting, like. That's what my father told me, and he was a reasonable man, though there's folks nowadays know what happened afore they were born better nor than they know their own business. What do you say to that, Dowlas? Said the landlord, turning to the farrier, who was swollen with impatience for his cue. There's a nut for you to crack. Mr. Dowlas was the negative spirit in the company, and was proud of his position.
Say? I say what a man should say as doesn't shut his eyes to look at a finger-post. I say, as I'm ready to wager any man £10, if he'll stand out with me any dry night in the pasture before the Warren stables, as we shall neither see lights nor hear noises, if it isn't the blowing of our own noses. That's what I say, and I've said it many a time. But there's nobody'll venture a 10-pun note on their ghosts as they make so sure of.
Why, Dowlas, that's easy betting, that is, said Ben Winthrop. You might as well bet a man as he wouldn't catch the rheumatiz if he stood up to his neck in the pool of a frosty night. It'd be fine fun for a man to win his bet as he'd catch the rheumatiz. Folks as believe in Cliff's Holiday aren't going to venture near it for a matter of £10.
"If Master Dowlas wants to know the truth on it," said Mr. Macy, with a sarcastic smile, tapping his thumbs together, "he's no call to lay any bet. Let him go and stand by himself. There's nobody will hinder him, and then he can let the parishioners know if they're wrong."
"Thank you. I'm obliged to you," said the farrier, with a snort of scorn. "If folks are fools, it's no business of mine. I don't want to make 'em out the truth about ghosts. I know it already. But I'm not against a bet. Everything fair and open. Let any man bet me £10 as I shall see Cliff's Holiday, and I'll go and stand by myself. I want no company. I'd as lief do it as I'd fill this pipe."
"Ah, but who's to watch you, Dallas, and see you do it? That's no fair bet," said the butcher.
"No fair bet," replied Mr. Dallas angrily. "I should like to hear any man stand up and say I want to bet unfair. Come now, Master Lundy, I should like to hear you say it."
"Very like you would," said the butcher, "but it's no business of mine. You're none of my bargains, and I aren't a-going to try and bait your price. If anybody'll bid for you at your own value, let him. I'm for peace and quietness, I am."
"Yes, that's what every yapping cur is when you hold a stick up at him," said the farrier. "But I'm afraid of neither man nor ghost, and I'm ready to lay a fair bet. I aren't a turn-tail cur."
"Aye, but there's this in it, Dowlas," said the landlord, speaking in a tone of much candour and tolerance. "There's folks, in my opinion, they can't see ghosts, not if they stood as plain as a pikestaff before them. And there's reason of that, for there's my wife now, can't smell, not if she'd the strongest of cheese under her nose. I'd never see a ghost myself, but then I says to myself, very like I haven't got the smell of them. I mean, putting a ghost for a smell, or else contrariwise, and so I'm for holding with both sides, for as I say, the truth lies between 'em. And if Dallas was to go and stand and say he'd never seen a wink of Cliff's Holiday all the night through, I'd back him. And if anybody said his Cliff's Holiday was certain sure, for all that, I'd back him too, for the smell's what I go by."
The landlord's analogical argument was not well received by the farrier, a man intensely opposed to compromise.
"Tar, tar,"
he said, setting down his glass with refreshed irritation.
"What's the smell got to do with it? Did ever a ghost give a man a black eye? That's what I should like to know. If ghosts want me to believe in 'em, Let him leave off skulking in the dark and in the lone places. Let him come where there's company and candles.
As if ghosts would want to be believed in by somebody so ignorant, said Mr. Macy, in deep disgust at the farrier's crass incompetence to apprehend the conditions of ghostly phenomena. The end of Part 1, Chapter 6 of Silas Marner by George Eliot. Read by Rick Kishner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.